Hi, folks. Next up on This Week in Law, Tiffany Lee and Reg Levy join Emery Roan and me to talk about the drone Raptor Patrol, Drake's next song, trading privacy for between $5 to $30 a month, and hashtag I'm loving it, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, everybody. It's time for our annual audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It helps us understand our audience better, know what you like and don't like, how you listen to the show. It also helps us tell advertisers what kind of people listen. But I promise you, your feedback is always kept personally anonymous. All you have to do is visit twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. It'll just take a few minutes, and it'll help us make Twit even better. We really appreciate your support and any help you can give us. twit.tv/survey.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Emery Roan, episode 336, recorded February 12th, 2016. IoT for CIA. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at freshbooks.com/twill. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all of the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Right now, get free expedited FedEx shipping when you go to ring.com/twill. Hi, folks. Welcome to This Week in Law, where we discuss the latest in law and technology policy and procedure every week. We're your daily dose of this stuff. So we're so glad that you've returned to watch the show if you're one of our regular listeners, and welcome if you're not. We're very happy to have you. Emery Roan is my co-host. Hi, Emery.
Hey, Denise. As always, thanks for having me. And for all you live listeners, get in the chat at IRC. We're in the chat right now.
Yep, irc.twit.tv. We would love to see you in there. Emery is an intern with our show and also with the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, former intern with New Media Rights and a second year law student. So great to see you again, Emery.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I just left a really great cybersecurity panel on Internet of Things hosted by CyberTech, a local San Diego networking thing, cybersecurity networking issue. And I think the issues are going to overlap with what we're talking about today. So I'm very excited.
I think they are. Yeah, we definitely are going to talk about some Internet of Things things. We also have two great guests joining us today. Tiffany Lee is joining us for her first time on This Week in Law. Welcome, Tiffany.
Hi, thanks, Denise.
Tiffany's a tech attorney, and she's a privacy fellow with the Wikimedia Foundation. What does that mean? What do you do for Wikimedia, Tiffany?
Sure. So the privacy fellows work in the legal department, doing in-house privacy work, setting up privacy programs, doing privacy research, working on memos, etc. It's a great program.
Excellent. And I'm sure really interesting issues come up in your day job. You're also a fellow in the inaugural class of the Internet Law and Policy Foundry. We've had other folks from the IP Law and Policy Foundry on before. It's a great organization. You should check it out if you are a young up-and-coming IP lawyer. So great to have you on the show, Tiffany.
Thanks again, Denise.
Also joining us for a return visit to This Week in Law is Reg Levy. She's an Apple geek, a law nerd, a tea snob, and a gamer, and she is self-described weirdly enamored of DNS. Hi, Reg. Great to have you back.
Great to be back. Thanks.
All right. We've got a lot to talk about today, so let's jump right into it. We're going to start out with some privacy stories. All right. There's a lot going on between the United States and the EU these days. We apparently have an agreement whereby personal data can now flow between the EU and the US to everyone's satisfaction. But there are some remaining issues there. Tiffany, can you explain what's going on for us and what remains to be concerned about?
Sure. So first, I can't speak on behalf of Wikimedia, obviously. These are my opinions as a private citizen. But basically what happened is that US and the EU used to have the Safe Harbor Agreement, which allowed data transfers between the US and the EU as a kind of exception instead of having to follow the rules of the EU Data Protection Regulation, which used to be the Data Protection Directive. So now we have a proposed new type of safe harbor agreement, which is the EU-US Privacy Shield, which everyone just loves because it's the, you know, the Avengers shield, really. Ideally, I would like to see this actually in a cartoon format instead of a legal document. But that's what we have right now. And there is some debate about whether US-EU Privacy Shield is something that will actually protect citizens, will actually protect EU data. And a lot of this debate stems on a focus on whether US mass surveillance makes the US incapable of protecting privacy. That's how I would sum it up.
All right, and has anyone actually been able to look at what the agreement, the new Privacy Shield, consists of? I saw on Epic's site that they attempted to do a FOIA request and were presented with nothing.
Right. So this is something, I love what Epic does. They definitely do want to try to get the information out there for us. They've done FOIA requests on different secret agreements in the past. And right now we don't have the concrete text of Privacy Shield. So I think mm-hmm. the FOIA request is a great idea. But eventually, I'm sure we'll see what the agreement is. And the agreement most likely is something similar to Safe Harbor, but not exactly the same.
Okay. So we don't know, because we don't know the details, whether there is anything in the new arrangement between the EU and the US that would deal with this problem. Recently, the Department of Homeland Security site was hacked. And of course, the DHS has tons of personal data about people who travel and other persons who are suspected on watch lists, et cetera, to be a threat to the United States. So hackers have breached the data that the U.S. Department of Homeland Security maintains. But under current law, non-U.S. persons don't have any legal rights when United States agencies fail to protect their data. What's your best guess, Tiffany, as to whether the new arrangement between the US and the EU does anything to address that?
So I would be doubtful that there's something specifically addressing this issue in Privacy Shield, just because mm-hmm. this is a US law issue, whether non-US citizens have rights within the US for redress against data leaks that occur because of the U.S. government. But I think it is an issue that moving forward will become even more important. And we saw the OPM data hacks last year, and now we have the DHS data hacks. So this is definitely going to be a problem that probably just continues and gets worse as technology improves. So I do think it's something we have to work on, but I'm not sure Privacy Shield will actually cover it. Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but we have other situations where non-U.S. citizens are entitled to the full extent of protection that a U.S. citizen would get, for example, if they're being tried in the United States. It's been a long time between now and my criminal procedure class in law school, but I believe that's the case. Con law comes into this, too. So correct me if I'm wrong on that point, but I think, there's some inconsistencies between how we treat folks from not within the U.S. for purposes of the protections of U.S. law. Emery, you're much closer to your con law and crim pro classes. Any insights there?
Well, actually, I haven't taken crim pro yet. That's coming up next semester, I think. But
got it. Okay. Be sure and ask that one for us.
Yeah, I'll hold off on that one and come back later. I'll come back in six months and let you know the answer. But specifically for the EU-US privacy shield, I think just on the title front, it's always alarming, I guess, when we get these sort of Patriot Act, Privacy Shield, Freedom Act bills that titles that don't usually reflect the actual body of the language of the text. So the fact that we don't have the language of this means that, you know, we're just going off of what we've heard. And the announcements are that, you know, there's going to be strong obligations on companies handling Europeans' personal data, clear safeguards and transparency obligations from the U.S. government access, and effective protection of EU citizens' rights with some possibilities of redress. But we don't really know what those specifics are. In the announcement, they say that the U.S. has, quote, ruled out indiscriminate mass surveillance on the personal data transferred to the U.S. under the new arrangement. But we're not entirely clear what they mean by that. Certainly, the upstream capabilities from the FISA Act are still in place. So, yeah, the question goes back to just like Tiffany was saying, the issue is whether or not the U.S. surveillance capabilities mean that we are incapable of actually securing EU citizens' data. And, you know, the hack in the past week has given credence to the argument that maybe we can't. Mike Masnick over on TechCrunch really wrote an awesome article about this and hit the issue on the nail on the head, I think, that for a lot of smaller companies, especially that, you know, want to deal with business in the EU, they really need some kind of safe harbor provisions because setting up data centers in Europe and in America may just be technically or economically not feasible. But is this going to provide accurate actual protections? I think it remains to be seen. And the jury is still out. And at least Max Schrems believes that this is going to get shut down in the EU courts anyways. So we're definitely going to be following this closely, but the jury's still out.
Right. So
I also think it bears mentioning that the NSA was spying on everyone, not just U.S. citizens and not just data within the U.S. So I don't think that this kind of a law is even going to do what the people who are proponents of it think it's going to do. It's not necessarily going to mean that EU citizens will be safe from U.S.-based hacking. It just means that their data, when it's in the United States, might be more safe, maybe.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
Because it's in the U.S. and protected in a certain kind of way. But it's not really – it can't do anything, right? You can't protect against a lot of this kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Right, but if it were a malicious attack – that released the data, if you're a U.S. citizen, you would have some recourse against a company who had been negligent in its data maintenance procedures. I don't know if the same thing would be true if you're not a U.S. citizen. And certainly, you know, when you throw in the fact that the government has various immunities, even from U.S. citizens, there's a whole other layer if the person getting hacked is the Department of Homeland Security. Any thoughts on that, Reg?
Yeah, I mean, there are some causes of action in the United States. Most tech companies are going to force you to sign that ability away with either an arbitration clause or just a clause that says we sure aren't liable for it. Negligence is different, but it's hard to prove when you get hacked, right? What qualifies as negligent if your house gets broken into? If you leave your house unlocked... Mm-hmm. That's one thing, but if you actually do lock it, that's another. And what kinds of locks are sufficient in the sense of an electronic break-in?
You know, I think that's one of the most interesting issues is that the idea that everyone's getting hacked. It doesn't, and you know, whether you're a huge player, a government actor, or a small business, you're still going to get hacked. I think that the elephant in the room really is that there isn't a real good solution to cybersecurity yet. And so personally, for like privacy advocates, the idea that we're just creating these hugely vulnerable data centers is a problem in itself.
Yeah, Omega Project in the chat said, we are collateral damage in the war on privacy. And I think that that's really true. Is it negligence when a company employee successfully gets phished because they didn't take to heart all of the training that they went through when they said, you know, please don't click on these kinds of links, but the phish was really good and really successful and now suddenly you're compromised? Does that count as negligence or is that just sort of criminal stupidity? So these are the kinds of things that as a tech company, I'm constantly concerned about. But as a citizen online, I take steps to protect myself. And at a certain point, I just have to trust that most of my information is not out there. I don't use medical, I don't use digital medical records, or I try not to. And I hope that the doctors that I see don't, and those sorts of things, because that's the kind of information I don't want to be public. But everything else, I pretty much assume is fair game.
And that medical data is going to be coming. I mean, it's going to come down the line and get digital. Right
Absolutely.
Now, medical data is 10 times more valuable than credit card data on the black market. And
100%.
There's a reason for that. So,
yeah.
Big issues.
Exactly.
Yeah. Very big issues. And I don't know about you guys, but just anecdotally, you know, my doctor definitely forever has been using sending digital documents back and forth. They do it through a secured portal. You can't just, you know, use your Gmail account to do it. But
secured portal, quote unquote.
Yeah, exactly. Once it's hacked, it's hacked. So.
Meanwhile, my financial advisor refuses to use PGP encryption because he doesn't understand it.
Well, you know, so I mean, I've stopped recommending people to use PGP because it's so easy to mess up. It's, you know, if you mess up PGP, you mess it up real bad. And you can
But there's so many super easy clients for both Mac and PC that
you have pinned to the top of your Twitter page, Reg, something that you recommended. Why don't you just mention it for us?
So GPG is a company that does PGP. So sorry, let me back up. PGP stands for Pretty Good Privacy, and it is an end-to-end encryption with shared keys and private keys and shared keys. And what that means is I have a piece of the code that encrypts my message to you, Denise, and you have a piece of the code that encrypted it. And each of us also has a secret key that we don't have the other side of. And so I can send an email to you that is fully encrypted, and you can only unlock it with my public key and your private key. Those two things have to match in order for it to be unlocked. And that sounds really complicated and difficult, but you can go to the MIT PGP server, create your own key, and then you download GPG for Mac or GPG for Windows. And it does its thing in your email system, and boom, it's done. You never have to think about it again.
That is fantastic. Thanks for recommending that and passing the information along. Let's talk about...
Sorry.
It's provided by...
That's part of my 2016 goal for no facts, because I think it's idiotic that lawyers, predominantly, sometimes also financial advisors, require things to be transmitted by fax as though that is secure in some way, even though most of the time it either goes to a shared fax machine in the middle of the office or an e-fax that just is in their email inbox now. So
right. Yeah, I poll of the panel, when's the last time anyone received a fax?
That's a really good
Never.
Question.
It's been at least 2 years, if not more, on my end.
You lucky bastards.
Are you still getting them?
I am still receiving them. I am still having this conversation and this struggle with lawyers that I hire for our company and with my personal financial advisors.
Wow. All righty then. The fax lives on. We thought it was
good,
dead.
No fax, CLE.
Yeah. Let's talk about something that has privacy ramifications that the FAA has declined to weigh in on. Once again, the Electronic Privacy Information Center is involved and trying to get the FAA to have some guidelines for drone privacy. There is a case before the Federal Appeals Court on this topic now. So the upshot for the time being is that the FAA is concerned about safety. They are making sure that they are in charge of who has permission to operate a drone commercially, and they're very in a piecemeal way issuing licenses to do so. But the privacy piece hasn't really been addressed by the FAA. And I don't know that the FAA is the appropriate agency to address the privacy piece, but Epic definitely thinks so. Reg, any thoughts on this?
So I think it borders on stupid, because people have been flying small planes off in fields for as long as I can remember. But that said, my mother-in-law gave my husband a drone for Christmas, and as soon as he opened the box, I was like, we have to register this with the FAA.
And we've passed the deadline. It's going to cost us $5 now.
Right. And I'm like, yes. First of all, I don't even know how to do it. And so, I mean, I could Google it. And second of all, we haven't flown it, and we live in a condo. We probably aren't going to fly it anytime soon. So I feel like us owning it is insufficient for registration. But once we decide to fly it, then maybe I'll look into it.
If you're just going to fly it around inside, then maybe the FAA doesn't need to be involved.
Of course, you know, we've covered it before, but the privacy issue around the registration is really the problem. And the registration has basically, all of your, it's a searchable database by registration number, and it pulls up your name, your address, and I think contact information for like phone number for anyone that registers a drone over, I think, like 50 grams. So personally, I mean, it seems like a really bad idea.
Yeah, that's a pretty huge privacy trade-off for sure.
Yeah,
especially,
you know, these are kids.
If the person searching on your drone has intent to shoot it down, that's even worse. Come to your house and take it out. Tiffany, I think you're, at least in your Twitter feed, this came up, and I've seen it elsewhere on the web. Is it Holland that is training some animals to help with the drone problem?
Oh, right. I think it was it eagles or some sort of hawk that they're being trained to attack drones from midair. So that's something that's happening now. That's there we go. There it is. This is
yes,
the state
Dutch
of our
National
world right
Police
now.
Are thinking that this, you know, rather than, this seems like a kinder, gentler way than shooting them down or otherwise taking them out. Raptors on the loose might provide other issues for people to get concerned about, but it certainly would be entertaining to see this in the wild, as it were. So
yeah, this seems like a new sport, like a new reality TV show, right? Instead of like battle bots, you can have hawk versus drone.
I'd watch it in a heartbeat.
I would too. Yeah,
we should make that show. That should be the next This Week in Law.
Yeah.
Talk to Leah.
Absolutely. The hawk versus drone edition. Let's talk briefly to round out our privacy stories, and then we're going to talk about privacy in another context, in the context of the Internet of Things, as we mentioned at the top of the show. But let's talk about this issue has come up before. PayPal deciding that it's not going to offer its services to certain VPNs. Torrent Freak follows this fairly closely, and they are the ones who found out and broke the story about a Canadian VPN that was recently cut off by PayPal. Of course, VPN stands for Virtual Private Network, and many people use VPNs, many businesses use VPNs to do exactly what we were discussing a moment ago, to try and secure sensitive data going back and forth between and among their employees and their customers and clients, et cetera. But of course, VPNs can also be used when you are traveling abroad to make it appear that your IP address is actually coming from within the U.S. And so, for example, Netflix doesn't work in various other countries. I don't know if it works in any other countries. I haven't traveled enough to know that
Netflix
it doesn't
work. Netflix is actually available in a lot of countries, but not the same content.
They are making a push to broaden that content to every country, though. I know recently they've just made a big push to get into many, many, many more countries. But at the same time, they've also said that they're going to actively try to stop people from using VPNs to get around location or region blockers.
Right. So, I mean, there is even no matter what countries they offer it in, your access is going to be different than your U.S. access. And if you're a U.S. person traveling abroad, you probably want to maintain your U.S. access. And some people use VPNs to get around the fact that, for example, in Mexico, you cannot get the same Netflix that you would get here. So, in fact, this VPN service in Canada initially marketed itself as a way to get around geo-blocking, and its name is Unotelly, and it has some graphics that suggest that perhaps privacy is not its first concern. It has since changed its marketing and is focusing on privacy and security now. But PayPal has said, you know, we think you're a company that's putting itself out there for people to get around Netflix's restrictions. We can't let you do that. So we're not going to let you use the service. Now its users are encouraged to use credit cards. But if rights holders decided to get up in arms about this, or if Netflix did, you know, they could go to the credit card companies as well and say, hey, you know, you're facilitating someone who's getting around our IP protection measures, and you should not do that. So it's an ongoing issue for VPNs and how they do business. Tiffany, any thoughts?
You know, personally, I have used VPNs mostly when abroad. And I think that they are very useful, not just for skirting the Netflix rules, but for people in nations where access to the internet or access to certain content online is blocked. So if we look at VPNs on that global scale, aside from just this, you know, Netflix Mexico versus Netflix US issue, blocking VPNs, or I guess stopping VPNs from being able to do business, is actually a human rights issue. And I don't know if it's PayPal's place right now to be working on human rights, but this is something that I think should be more in the discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Internet access is a human right, and, you know, almost a necessity of life these days. Communication and secure communication are something that I don't know if I agree. I agree with you, Tiffany, that I don't know if Netflix should be in the business of enforcing that someone doesn't have access to that.
I think that's really the issue. I think that, you know, the Bitcoin community is pointing at this and, you know, saying that this is exactly what's wrong with PayPal, when, you know, whether or not the Unotelly was, you know, marketing itself specifically as a way to get around copyright restrictions using Netflix and VPNs. I think the issue is that it shouldn't be PayPal's place to make that call. It feels sort of this weird, slimy, extrajudicial way where the companies are, you know, policing the users copyright for copyright reasons, which is just sort of weird. Tiffany was absolutely right. VPNs are a public necessity for a lot of people in countries that have their internet monitored more than ours. So,
I think for financial services companies, as for ISPs, the analysis they have to do is, who are we more afraid of? You know, who do we want to be sued by? Do we want to be sued by Hollywood studios and video distribution providers, or do we want to be sued by our customers, potentially? You know, do we think they have the wherewithal to band together and do that?
It's just scary that, you know, PayPal is a payment system. You know, people use PayPal to buy things, and so it's effectively your bank saying, you can't do this. You know, and the fact that this payment service is just stopping the transaction in the middle is a little alarming, because it might set a precedent down the line. If PayPal decides that they want to align their interests with, you know, whatever lobbying group, and they decide that, we're going to stop allowing these kind of businesses to operate, Sounds like it sets a bad precedent to me.
What do you think, Brad? Should PayPal be able to pick who its customers are based on its own risk management concerns?
I think, unfortunately, that ship has sailed because PayPal and MasterCard and American Express already do that. But I don't think that they should be able to. To Emery's point, they're a bank. They should give my money to the person I want to give it to when I tell them to, and not refuse to do that because they don't like the person I want to give it to. I use VPNs constantly. I am on a VPN right now because I travel internationally, and I partially subscribe to Netflix and Hulu so that when I'm in a hotel in the middle of somewhere else and I'm jet lagged and I want to get some work done, I can turn on a movie or a TV show in the background and watch it. And it doesn't matter that I'm not at home. I think that's exactly what it should be used for, and that that is a legal use of it. If I were a citizen of another country using it to get around the content laws of that country, maybe that's a little bit more squirrely. But this is not the purview of PayPal or of Netflix to say, just because you happen to be in China for a week right now, you're not allowed to access the content that you pay for.
Yeah, it's a fascinating issue. And as the world gets smaller and smaller and people continue to travel around it, it's going to come more and more to the fore. As it is, you know, you don't hear that much about VPNs being cut off, but I think we will hear more of it in the future. Let's take a break and thank our first sponsor. That's who we're talking about, our sponsor of this episode of This Week in Law, and that is FreshBooks. If you're a freelancer or run a small business, chances are your least favorite part is rummaging through receipts, trying to keep track of your expenses, creating, formatting, and sending invoices, and the worst, tracking down customers who don't pay you on time. FreshBooks is the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of businesses like yours the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. I use FreshBooks in my practice. I actually have not had to go to the paid version of FreshBooks, but it does have the ability to use the service for free for a limited amount of clients. Once you're sending out lots and lots of invoices, there is a marginal amount that you pay every month. But it's very reasonably priced for what you receive and how wonderful the service is. You'll be creating and sending invoices in minutes, and you get paid online right away with FreshBooks payments. You can get paid up front. You can request a deposit now in FreshBooks so that you no longer need to cover costs out of pocket while waiting until the end of a project to get paid. Plus, FreshBooks recently announced their new card reader. You can easily accept credit cards wherever business takes you quickly and securely right from your phone in less than a minute. FreshBooks card reader is EMV chip card enabled. That's the new standard in the U.S., With their entirely redesigned iPhone app, you can conduct business anywhere. You can send an estimate right after you shake the client's hand and bring them on board. You can send an invoice as soon as the work is done while it is fresh in the client's mind, instead of waiting until the end of a billing cycle or until the end of a month or what have you, when the memory of the great work that you've done is maybe a bit distant and your client is not real happy to receive an invoice at that point. It's very easy to track all of your billable time. Now you'll know how long your projects really take, and you can throw away your shoebox full of receipts and track expenses on the spot using your phone's camera. That works much better. All this allows you to focus on what you love the most, growing your business. You'll wonder why you didn't start with FreshBooks sooner. If you have questions, help us free forever, and you can always count on FreshBooks award-winning support rock stars to go above and beyond whenever you need a hand. Getting started is simple and it's totally free for 30 days. Go to freshbooks.com/twill and don't forget to enter This Week in Law in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Start your 30-day free trial today. Thank you so much, FreshBooks, for your support of this episode of This Week in Law. All right, let's shift gears just a bit from the international arena to the kitchen and the living room and talk about the Internet of Things.
Mm.
don't think I've ever seen that bed music. That was wonderful.
Yes.
That's a fantastic graphic.
Yeah. That would be our bumper for robots, the Internet of Things, wearable tech, the singularity. We sort of throw it all under that umbrella. And right now, let's talk about, we've already been talking about ways in which data that is gathered about us is stored. Now let's talk about the different ways that data is being gathered about us, not via your email or a fax, but via, for example, your refrigerator or your car or the fitness monitor on your wrist. Or if you, we recommended this as a resource of the week a few weeks back. If you tune into Showtime's Darknet series, which I took to heart and started watching, it's a little bit sensationalistic, but episode two I really liked. It was all about wearables and implants. And there was one guy in particular who had lost an eye. He was a documentary filmmaker and decided, gee, wouldn't it be fun and helpful for my profession if I somehow managed to install a camera in my empty eye socket? And it looked realistic enough that I could go around and talk to people and they would not know that I was filming them.
So, that is super cool.
Yeah. So, you know, they do a nice, they seem to do like three different segments during the show, this Darknet series on Showtime, and they kind of jump around between them. So they cover him between their various efforts to create an eye that would actually look somewhat realistic, or at least look just like a false eye and not like a camera. So interesting. I encourage you to check it out. So not only your fridge and your Fitbit, but perhaps the guy walking down the street. Lots of other interesting things in that show too, about not just cameras, but having your own body become your home for the data about you, so that you could have an RFID chip, for example, in your arm that you use to get into the gym or your secured building. So the Internet of Things is definitely evolving in ways that perhaps people have not anticipated, or if they have anticipated, they haven't thought it was coming quite this quickly. And of course, the CIA thinks this is just wonderful. And its head has recently come out and said, oh, yes, you know, we will definitely use the data gathered by the Internet of Things to assist intelligence mm-hmm. officials and law enforcement. There's a great article in The Guardian quoting Director James Clapper. So with all this on the table, let's go around the horn here and discuss the Internet of Things, particularly interesting in the wake of CES last month. Emery, are you just, you know, I mean, we're talking about not having digital medical records go back and forth. How do you feel about all these devices in your life?
You know, I'm so torn because I am exactly the target audience. I cannot wait to get my, you know, robotic eye and my robot feet, just like extend them my way. I'm all about it. But right now I don't own a Fitbit. I don't own any IoT devices in my apartment yet. And that is because the way that they are using our data is insane right now. you know, I'm working at the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse right now, which is an excellent nonprofit that does education and advocacy about privacy issues, consumer facing. And in 2014, we published a study that looked at the top 43 health and fitness tracking apps on iOS and Android. And what they found was that across the board, the apps were sending data that isn't regulated by HIPAA. Across, you know, they're selling it, they're data brokering it. Something like 60% of the free apps that they looked at and 40% of the paid apps not only didn't have links to the privacy policies on the web, on the apps itself, but it didn't even have privacy policies on the website, which is obviously really alarming, considering we're talking about how our data is stored and sold. And yeah, you know, the issue with the Internet of Things and with internet connected devices and the privacy context is huge. That's one of the big hot button issues, is so many of these data devices are getting personally identifiable information, sometimes health information that, like we said earlier, is extremely valuable. And, you know, none of the regulations that we currently have are governing these companies. There's a lot of smaller companies, new companies, new startups with maybe less than expert programmers, because the hardware is so easy to produce, are putting out these products that have a very short lifespan on the shelf, but that can continue ticking and continue to be connected to the internet and are not sophisticated enough to have sophisticated security on the device itself. So you have a network of just really insecure, dumb smart devices that can leak information, sell information, you know, maybe serve malware. You know, the avenues of where this could go wrong are they're everywhere. So it's a really big issue. You see a couple of, you know, a lot of people are talking about ways to handle the Internet of Things. Steve Gibson over on Security Now says that you need to have a separate router, a separate network on your home specifically for these smart devices. And, you know, right now that certainly seems like the only real option. I just left a cybersecurity meeting this morning, a roundtable discussion, largely about securing IoT. And yeah, you know, there's not a real clear solution right now, but I guarantee we're going to have data breaches. And somewhere down the line, someone's smart fridge or smart telephone or smart light bulbs are going to leak. Smart telephone, what a novel concept. Are going to leak some really important information that's going to result in some damages. Whether at that point the public responds by demanding increased privacy rules remains to be seen. A lot of, you know, there's an argument to be made that the public is just getting desensitized to this. You know, there's so many breaches, so many hacks. It's not really really clear whether or not the market is responding in a way that says that we need to prevent these kind of activities or curtail them. Most of the time, it looks like consumers are still shopping at Target, still shopping at Home Depot, still using PlayStation Network. So yeah, it's a really tough issue. IoT is hugely vulnerable, and I don't think there's a clear roadmap of where we go from here to secure it.
Right. Well, you're talking about potential regulations against the companies that would gather the data. But it's funny you're talking about smartphones and how we've all become used to that idea. Cash Hill has recently written up at Fusion an article about Symphony, which also has been written about at Wired, that is basically taking the phone and providing people with an app where they can gather data about themselves that Symphony is going to use to make their lives better and more convenient, et cetera. And they're actually they're going to share that data. And because they're going to share that data, they're going to pay $5 a month for the privilege. So there's a whole other layer here where if you're willing to, you know, give up your data for pay, that strikes me as something that's a real dangerous, slippery slope too.
We're already
giving up data to get services for free, but this takes it a step further, and I think it leads to some potentially really bad outcomes. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, one of the arguments is that we're getting to a place where privacy is a commodity that you have to pay to afford. And right. I think that that's what we're seeing coming out of this. And that's really, really alarming, because we're going to create an underclass of people that do not have privacy, because they're going to need to have these fitness trackers in order for their insurance provider to give them the premium that they can afford, or they're going to need to have these intelligent light bulbs so that they can use the correct amount of energy so that their electricity company gives them the right prices. So IoT is coming out there, and the idea that we're just giving up security voluntarily for $5 a month is so scary.
Well, there's two sides to that, right? There's you use my data because I use Facebook, and so you're scraping my data and you're selling it to other people, but I don't benefit from that. Facebook. Okay, let's put that aside, whether or not that is a benefit. So why not allow me to charge for it? If you want to know a certain piece of information about me, well, then let's put a dollar value on that, and I will share it with you if you compensate me fairly. And I think that to some extent that might actually be a fair distribution of that kind of tracking information. And to the point of an insurance company requiring you to wear a Fitbit, I already wear a Fitbit. I don't know whether or not I would be comfortable sharing that information with my insurance company or even my doctor, honestly. But my insurance company for my car also says if you drive less than a certain amount annually, then you get a different premium. And they send me every quarter, I think, they send me a document that says, put in your current mileage information, and we will use that to make sure that you're still, you know, driving under the right amount and you're maintaining it. I have the option of also allowing them to put something in my car that will track it for them, but currently self-reporting is sufficient. But to some extent, that's been here for 10, 20 years. I mean, this isn't new. And the only thing that's new about it is now it's able to be shared online. There's right. a university in Oklahoma, Oral Roberts, which is a private university that is currently requiring its students to wear Fitbits just to make sure that everybody's getting the exercise that they require. And there's been a lot of talk about that around. And I don't know what I think about that. I don't know whether or not I agree that a university should encourage its students to be active. And I don't know what kinds of punishments there might be if they don't. So I'm not sure about that one.
Well, Reg, you're not comfortable sharing the information with your doctor, but you are comfortable sharing it with Fitbit.
That is 100% correct. Yeah. And that's a very good point. I mean, it took me a while to get there, honestly. There for a while I had a pedometer and that was fine, but I wanted it to sync to my phone. And so now it's online and Fitbit's using it. You're absolutely correct.
And Fitbit's selling it.
And now I have a new car and it has all kinds of crazy features and I am terrified of it. I recently read that they can hack a car with a CD. You just put the CD in the CD drive and there's something in it that will coordinate with all of the rest of the operating system of your car and allow someone to get root on it, which means they can turn it off while you're in the middle of driving it. And it's the whole thing is terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. Tiffany, you haven't weighed in on this yet. Any thoughts?
Honestly, I don't think it's that big a deal. If you think about it, there were ways to hack cars in the past. For example, you would physically go in and hotwire the car that was hacking in the old days, back when. And now we just have more sophisticated technology. And I think that as technology improves, we will always have people who try to circumvent that technology, circumvent any security mechanisms we have. So this isn't really something new. I do think, though, that with increase in data being collected about literally everyone right now, we do need to have more privacy protections. And I think this is something that privacy advocates have been working on, but this is also something that consumers have to care about. Because at the end of the day, if consumers don't care about privacy, companies won't care about privacy either. So really, what I'm saying is it's none of our faults, really. It's everyone else's.
Well, the thing that concerns me, too, about the privacy underclass that Emery mentioned a moment ago is because it means, if you take it to its logical conclusion, that not only do the folks who opt in to get paid $5 a month to have information gathered about them that is not being gathered about others, but it means the data is not necessarily representative either, because there's going to be a certain kind of person or a certain socioeconomic level at which the $5 a month is meaningful to you to sacrifice that privacy. And there's going to be another level at which it's not. So the data is going to be skewed. It's not going to be representative necessarily. So,
and, you know, another point on that is, you know, to the argument that we have to make consumers care about this because otherwise the businesses aren't, you know, I think you're absolutely right. But I think that that might be leaving out part of the discussion, which is that, you know, there can be a market for people, a market of people, of consumers that are okay with this, that just make that exchange worthwhile for the businesses. So even though there may be, maybe it's a minority, maybe it's not even a minority of people that care about their privacy. But if you, for example, in the broadband article that we have on the show topics list today, you know, this is a an ISP giving $30 per month off if you allow them to, the ISP, to basically analyze your web traffic and send you advertisements. And it's very hard for anyone to argue with that. But for the people that do argue with, that do pay that $30, that might be a minority, but there's still enough people that aren't going to do it that it's still worthwhile for the business to make that choice. So it's kind of the tragedy of the commons, or, you know, the mob of the majority. You know, it would be such a shame if there's just a small enough market of people that are okay giving $5 a month for Symphony that that sort of becomes the norm rather than the exception.
Right. And what Emery is referring to is a piece in Fortune that is writing about an ISP that the FCC is taking a look at. And I'm trying to get to what it's called. Do you remember its name, Emery?
Oh, gosh, I'm pulling it up. I'm sorry, I don't.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
It was in the show notes, I swear.
Yeah, no, it is. And can Fortune, get to those. Go ahead.
Yes, it was Fortune, your biggest potential data leak isn't your Nest, it's your ISP. Right. So if you search for that, you can find it. And It was AT&T. Yeah,
it AT&T. Was AT&T. Upwards, yeah, so it was
their
a biggie.
Fiber market. Yeah, it's one of the big ones. This is the big one.
Yeah.
Saying that this is for your fiber optics. If you have fiber internet, and they'll give you $30 off per month. That is huge over the year for the majority of people that are using that.
It certainly is.
This is great. I'll turn it on and then use my VPN.
Yeah, that was my thought. And when people like PayPal,
if your
saying,
VPN is still in business.
Yeah.
You know, that's why it's so alarming when PayPal is deciding extrajudicially to prevent these kind of businesses, you know? How long down the line is it that PayPal says, oh, you know, well, getting around your ISP's advertising tracking is against our terms as well. So it's problematic.
Yeah, definitely. Well, at least the FCC is taking a look at this. I don't know what its jurisdiction would be over this kind of program. Again, it's a federal agency that's not necessarily concerned with privacy as its mandate, but that's what's at stake here if it's going to regulate.
Just to get into the legal weeds, if we want to just talk about, just for people that might be interested, currently it's just Section 5 of the Telecommunications Act that the FCC has traditionally been able to use to regulate internet providers, and that is just the unfair business practices, I think. What this article is talking about is the CDT and Epic are both trying to get the FCC to regulate broadband under Section 222, which would require them to set rules for privacy and the use of personal data. So Privacy Rights Clearinghouse also signed on to that letter, the idea being that the FCC, now that we are classifying broadband as under Section 222 with the open internet rules, they should also be required to follow the privacy regulations as well. So,
okay. Go ahead.
I think that's a very interesting administrative law issue. The FCC so far hasn't really taken any power over privacy. It's traditionally an FTC realm. So I'm interested in seeing what the FCC does. And like we were mentioning earlier today, the FAA might be involved in privacy, at least for drones or other manned birds of prey, apparently. So we'll see that in the future, I think, more agencies trying to take more of a bite of this privacy power that we'll see. For example, right now, the White House recently just created a federal privacy council. So I'm sure that will become a bigger issue in the future. We're going to see more and more privacy issues coming about and more agencies trying to take control over some sort of privacy enforcement.
Yes. And, who knows if the privacy council would ever have the same kind of enforcement power that the FCC and the FTC and the FAA enjoy today, but it may be that we're looking down the road at an agency that might. given that the fact that these issues are coming up more and more. Let's make free ISP our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases in the show in case you are listening for mandatory continuing legal or other professional education credit. There will be another one at some point before we wrap up today. And we put them in so that you can show your oversight body that you actually watched or listened and did not just write down episode 336 of This Week in Law on a piece of paper and turn it in. So free ISP is our first passphrase. And if you are interested in reading the Fortune article or any of the other points that we've discussed today, any of the other source material we've used in putting together the show, you can go to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. And as I mentioned, we're episode 336. So if you go to 336 in our tags, you will find all of the stuff we've discussed during today's show. Let's thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law. It's just about straight up noon here in California right now, lunchtime. Perfect time to be rustling up some Blue Apron if you haven't already done so. You know, you need to know how to cook, whether it's lunch or dinner. I'm afraid they're not servicing breakfast yet, but, you know, stay tuned. Maybe they'll be able to help you rustle up some pancakes and waffles in the future. Not only now, though, will you know your way around the kitchen for lunch and dinner, but cooking at home means eating healthier and saving money instead of ordering expensive takeout again. But where do you start? Blue Apron has you covered. You're going to spend less than $10 a meal. That's far less than going out. And the quality of the food that you get is definitely excellent restaurant caliber. It delivers all the fresh ingredients you need to create home-cooked meals with all the things easily segregated, measured, ready for you to go, and accompanied by easy step-by-step instructions. Each meal can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. No more overwhelming trips to the grocery store on Super Bowl Sunday, for example. Last place you want to be is in a store, but if you had thought ahead and pre-ordered the Blue Apron selections for that week, one thing that I love that they do is they do sort of take into account, hey, this would be a good week to have a certain kind of food based on the fact that there's a holiday or an event. So you'll enjoy that with Blue Apron once you signed up. You'll also enjoy that no matter what your dietary preference is, Blue Apron makes it a breeze to discover and prepare dishes like Trinidadian chicken curry with coconut grits and collard greens, or sumac roasted sweet potato and farro salad with pickled onion and hazelnuts right in your own kitchen. Cook with ingredients that you might never have used before, such as watermelon radishes, farro, and purple potatoes. Recipes are between 500 to 700 calories per portion, and they're delicious and good for you. Right now, you can get your first two meals free just by going to blueapron.com/twit. Check out this week's menu and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. Thank you so much, Blue Apron, for your support of This Week in Law. All righty, let us move on to an issue that I suspect Reg might be paying attention to, and that is the trademark status of hashtags. So obviously lots of words can be trademarks. Trademarks are used in a certain area of commerce by certain companies that register them. And if you're in a different area of commerce, you may well be able to register a trademark that has already been registered by somebody else. It just, you're trying not to confuse the public and consumers. So when you throw hashtags into the mix, things get interesting. Can you tell us a bit about this, Reg?
So the hashtag, the Twitter, pound symbol. Mm-hmm. Everybody uses it. Everybody who tweets uses it. Everybody who Instagrams uses it. Like, whoa. Tumblr mm-hmm. also has it. And recently, people have been applying for trademarks in it, which is just totally bizarre to me because hashtags are sort of by nature ephemeral, right? I used a hashtag yesterday, KSK. That was really only relevant yesterday. And today, maybe somebody else will use it for something different. And the nature of hashtags being so ephemeral, the fact that people even want to trademark this is just absolutely baffling to me. Mm-hmm. And I put it right up there with Taylor Swift trying to trademark this sick beat. I don't even know what people are thinking.
All right. So can you give us some concrete examples of things that are not yet a trademark, but have been given life in the hashtag arena and someone has trotted down to the USPTO?
I think this was the blurred lines case that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the BuzzFeed article, and blurred lines is two words in trademark, as far as I know, and they combined mm-hmm. it and threw a hashtag on it and have applied for it. I don't believe, though, that it has been granted yet. Am I wrong in that?
I'm not following it, so I'm not sure.
This is, I'm just looking at it from, right, exactly. I don't believe that it's been granted yet. It's difficult to convince the Patent and Trademark Office to grant a patent for even domain names. Mm-hmm. Certainly, you're not allowed to patent a top-level domain. So I don't think any of these are going to pass muster. And with the length of time that's required to get a trademark on it in the first place, I don't think anybody's going that it's going to be successful for anyone at all.
All right. Emery, any thoughts?
You know, I don't have great expertise in trademarks, so I'm going to avoid saying anything and putting my foot in my mouth. But it just seemed, from my cursory understanding of trademark, that this would be the kind of thing that businesses would jump at, informing consumer expectations. I would think that McDonald's would be all about trademarking hashtag I'm loving it or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I think that the overzealously trademarking things is never a good idea.
Right. And I'd also say, I'm loving it is also just a phrase that people might use, and you might say it in a tweet ironically and say, mm-hmm. I'm having breakfast at my mom's, hashtag I'm loving it. And mm-hmm. I don't think anyone thinks that that's an endorsement of McDonald's or even an incorrect use of the trademark if it were a trademark.
Yeah, it seems to me like there actually needs to be some clarification from the USPTO as to when it's going to be okay or if it's going to be okay to trademark a hashtag, because trademarks traditionally have been used to identify a business, and by definition, a hashtag is used to further a conversation in whatever forum that it's being used in, Reg. As you mentioned, all of the various ones where you're likely to see.
Well, I think hashtags are used to signal something. They're used to signal expectations, cue in a reader that there is mm-hmm. a larger dialogue going on related to, whatever they're hashtagging. So I don't know.
Right.
I'm curious is why would they trademark something? What would be the redressive
footage? To suggest that there might be a conversation around something that actually there is not one around, but is just funny to throw into your post.
Well, right. And sometimes I will throw in a really long and obnoxious hashtag as a joke, right? So mm-hmm. hashtag I'm having breakfast at my mom's. Because Instagram and Tumblr actually support hashtags with spaces in them. So you can have a hashtag on Instagram and Tumblr. Actually, maybe it's only Tumblr that supports it. But you can have a tag back when we blogged, right? These were just called tags mm-hmm. to categorize your post. And it can be multiple words. It can have a space in it. So Tumblr and Instagram are notorious for having these really long hashtags. Twitter, you don't get them as long because you are limited to 140 characters in total. So when you see a really long hashtag in Twitter, it's more of a it's for comedic effect. But I don't really think that these are trademarkable, as for the points that you brought up, Denise, because mm-hmm. it's not really distinguishing a business. If anything, it's distinguishing a particular advertising a marketing plan of the business, right? It's not hashtag right. McDonald's, it's hashtag I'm loving it. Those are two different things.
Right. Tiffany, anything for us on this?
Sure. I think that first we should recognize the genius of Alexandra J. Roberts' BuzzFeed article. I love seeing complicated legal issues written about primarily using GIFs. I think that's fantastic. I mean, it's a very new concept, right? This trademarks of hashtags. So I think this is a very novel way to introduce the topic to an audience that probably doesn't want to read a law review article. Right. By the way, though, I am attending the Works in Progress IP conference at the University of Washington next week. And the one Works in Progress that I'm most excited to hear about is actually the law review article Alexandra J. Roberts is writing on this topic. So I'm sure that this is going to actually be a concrete legal analysis. But for now, the BuzzFeed version is also good. And it's interesting. Honestly, I don't know if it's going to be an issue that we look to in maybe 5 years. I think we're already seeing that younger people, the kids and teens these days, aren't really using hashtags as much as they used to. So if they are the future of the internet, then the future of the internet might not need trademarks for hashtags.
It might not. Emery, were you serious before the show that you were not aware that BuzzFeed's format was pretty much headlines and GIFs?
I mean, I knew the reputation, but I didn't think that literally the format of their article is headline GIF, headline GIF, headline GIF, like byline. Like, that's it. That's literally the entire thing. And I've got to say, Tiffany, you have cast it in a much better light than I initially had when I saw the article. But I can get behind what you're saying. We do need, if this is how you educate lay people about, complex legal issues, I guess this works.
Yep. I can get behind it, I think. I can also get behind it as Drake's next song instead of Hotline Bling, Headline GIF. Why not?
There we go.
Yeah. Yes.
I guess one question I had with about this too, hopefully to our other guests that are more knowledgeable about trademarks than I am, but the whole, when we get down to it, I don't really understand why you would want to trademark a hashtag. I guess what would be the redress ability if you, like, the situation would be that someone would trademark Deflategate, and then whoever owns that trademark could then send takedowns to people that use that hashtag? Like, what?
Right. That's the other part of this that is absolutely baffling to me. If McDonald's trademarks hashtag I'm loving it, and I don't know why I'm fixated on that one, that means that I cannot tweet it. So I cannot go to McDonald's and say...
Undermines the whole purpose of the hashtag.
Right. I am enjoying my Big Mac. Hashtag I'm loving it. That would be an infringement because I am not authorized to use the trademark. If I am authorized to use the trademark, then it's not a trademark. So this whole thing is just, I feel like some lawyers got their hands on something and decided to run with it and just don't understand the technology, honestly, because it's ephemeral. It's supposed to signify a conversation, and it's supposed to encourage additional conversation about that thing. And if you trademark it, it's no longer ephemeral, and it shuts down the conversation because you limit who can speak about it, who can use the word.
Yeah, that was my question.
Key here. Awesome. Mm-hmm.
Tiffany, what were you saying?
Sure. I think what's key here is that companies probably won't shut down all mentions of their trademarks, right? Even if they can trademark a hashtag, they will only use that, that trademark power to shut down uses of their trademarks that they don't want. So, for example, if you tweet something with "I'm loving it" next to a picture of McDonald's hamburger, I'm sure they won't try to shut that down. If you tweet that next to, say, a picture of something negative about McDonald's, then they can actually shut it down. So I don't think this is going to be curtailing speech, really, except for the type of speech that companies don't want. So there will still be use of the hashtags, but this will just be a way for them to manage, I guess, how to manage their brands online, which really is the, you know, the core of trademark law, really, the ability to manage the intellectual property that you own.
So correct me on trademark law then, because my understanding is that if I don't police the mark, I lose the mark, right? So if somebody out there is using my company's trademark and I am not authorizing it and I don't shut it down, then I lose the ability to authorize it to other people in the future. Is that not correct?
So what I would predict would happen would be that the companies would still, you know, like you said, police the mark. They would look for infringing uses. They would shut down some uses. But I'm going to guess that they would allow some more innocuous uses on Twitter, on Facebook, things that they actually like. And this would still be considered them kind of keeping tabs on their own trademark, because they would still be shutting down probably a significant number of, you know, blogs, tweets, Facebook posts about their trademark.
Okay,
but Denise,
so as long
you know
as...
more about this.
Well, I was just going to say that I think there's something to what Reg brings up, and that this is possibly a door that trademark owners do not want to open, because if they do decide to try and selectively police hashtag speech, they might find themselves losing a trademark in the bargain. If we had Marty Schwimmer on the show, who is our semi-regular trademark expert who comes on, he could tell us all about this. So maybe we'll bring him on soon and resurrect this topic. But I personally can't tell you how much policing is enough to be able to keep your mark. But I know that, you know, there's at least a danger that what Reg is saying could happen if you decide, oh, you know, that actually helps us, so we're going to let that one stay, or that one disparages our brand, so we're going to ask to take it down.
I think it also has to do with who's using it. If it's just the general public who are allowed to use it, I think that would go into the factors of whether or not the policing is taking place.
You know, there's also the issue of in Maryland, and I know Maryland is pushing a bill right now, but California currently has one that prevents companies using sort of gag orders or gag clauses in their contracts that prevents people from going to Yelp and writing negative reviews about the business. So I'd imagine that at some point there's a free speech issue here about, you know, using this hashtag to review bad business practices, whether or not that would... You know, if companies could use a trademark issue to take down bad reviews because it says hashtag I'm loving it, ironically. We really got to move on from hashtag I'm loving it. But.
Right.
Yeah,
another one
is this is actually McDonald's.
Yeah, not at all. But one of the examples in the BuzzFeed piece is Ask JPM, Ask JP Morgan, from tweeted by someone who was highly dissatisfied with their services, and was making that clear by co-opting their own marketing hashtag. Let's move on to something that our panel is anxious to discuss. We're going to talk about one of the most interesting copyright battles around one of the most boring aspects of the legal profession, which is something called the Blue Book, which is the Bible for how you cite legal authorities to courts and any other citations of legal authorities. Before we get there, we are going to thank our final sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is the Ring Video Doorbell. We're all familiar with the sound of a doorbell. It means a package is being delivered or friends are coming over for dinner, but it's also potentially the sound of someone planning to rob you. It's also potentially the sound of someone interrupting you. For example, for me, doing the show out of my home, I'm here in my home office, which is where I practice from and do the show from. So for me, you know, obviously I wouldn't even be looking at the Ring video doorbell right now. But if I weren't on air with you all, if I were just sort of working away for a client and could be interrupted for a few moments, it is wonderful to be able to have the ability to know who's at your door and make the decision whether or not you're going to answer. And if it's someone nefarious at your door, oop, there's someone now, to take steps to make sure that your home is safe and secure. Over 95% of home break-ins happen during the day, and burglars almost always start by ringing your doorbell to see if someone's home before pillaging your possessions. With the Ring video doorbell, you can see and talk to anyone at your front door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. Ring's advanced motion detection alerts you even if someone doesn't ring the doorbell. And one thing I really like about their motion detection system is it has some very fine-tuned controls over how sensitive the sensor is going to be. So you can aim the sensor in a certain direction, depending on how your door's oriented, so that you will capture people walking up to the door and perhaps not people playing in the yard next door or at the door itself. You can control the sensitivity of the sensor. So if your door is right adjacent to a street, the cars going by are not going to set it off. It's great. Once you've been using it for a little while, you can see whether it's been going off too much for your taste, and you can fine tune it and make it go off just the right amount to let you know when someone's actually standing there at the door wanting to go in. Of course, when someone rings the doorbell, then the motion sensors not even necessary. You immediately have the option to have audio conversation with the person at your door. You can talk to delivery people and keep an eye on your package. You can tell them if you decide to do so that you're not home and they should leave the package, or that, you know, maybe you just leave out the not home part and have them leave the package for you to pick up later. If someone tries to mess with your Ring video doorbell, you'll get an instant alert and HD video of the whole thing. So it does protect itself somewhat. It's like having a neighbor keep an eye on your home 24/7. It's a really wonderful device for people who do telecommute and work at home, because there are instances where you just simply don't want to go get the door, and it helps you know whether you need to get up and interrupt what you're doing, or it's something that you can just leave alone. And you can also have a conversation with the person who's standing there at your door and make sure that you've dealt with what you need to before having to actually go there and answer. Installing Ring takes minutes, and it works with either your current wiring or a built-in rechargeable battery. Put your mind at ease and protect your home with the video doorbell Time Magazine and USA Today named one of their top 10 gadgets. Go to ring.com/Twill for a free expedited FedEx delivery of this device. That's ring.com/Twill. With Ring, you are always home. Thank you so much, Ring, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let's talk about the Blue Book for our non-lawyer audience who is very happy they've never heard of the Blue Book before. I'll just briefly tell you that it is a spiral bound blue covered book that has been around since the earlier part of the 20th century, that is a very strict guide to how things should be cited. If you're writing a brief and filing it with a court, it is necessary that you consult this thing and submit your citations in the format the court requires, because it's kind of like when you're reading through a self-published novel that hasn't been edited very carefully. If you leave out a comma or have bad grammar in the writing, it's immediately what the reader fixates on. And courts, for good or ill, immediately fixate if your Blue Book citation format is not proper. So for lawyers, it's a very important part of how we practice law. And in the past, it has been the purview solely of the Harvard Law Review Association, who publishes and has the copyright in it. However, one version of the Blue Book apparently never had its copyright renewed, and this has been the entree to publish a free and open source version of the Blue Book called Baby Blue, being spearheaded by Carl Malamud and Professor Christopher John Sprigman. It's now getting some pushback from said Harvard Law Review Association because they're claiming that Blue Book material is being copied without authorization and published in a free and open source way. So, Reg, what's your take on all this, and what do you forecast for the future of Baby Blue?
Well, my frustration with the Blue Book stems from the fact that I was once a law student, and my LRW professor hammered into our brains the fact that the Blue Book was the only possible way of writing certain things. And the fact that it didn't have an acceptable way of citing things like tweets or even a good way of citing websites was an ongoing source of frustration for me. So I'm really happy that it has A, competitor, B, one that's open source, and C, one that's kind of modern, so it might actually take into account certain internet resources. And the Baby Blue has now been published, and it does actually have a good way of citing to internet resources. Mm-hmm. I think that the argument that the Blue Book is copyright is fine, but the Blue Book system is not copyrighted any more than the English language is. So bravo for the, I think it's the Yale Law Review for creating Baby Blue.
Yes, we have a little Ivy League internecine battle going on here with Yale deciding that Baby Blue is the way they're going to go. Instead of Harvard. And just a little inside baseball for those of you who've watched the show for a long time. Christopher Sprigman has joined us before. He's a wonderful professor, wonderful guest. He also is the guy who represented the individual who got sued for making a 3D or printed version of Left Shark after the Super Bowl. So I think of him as Left Shark Chris, but he's obviously done many, many other things in his illustrious career. Emery, you're a law student. You're about to embark on the world of having to cite things to courts, potentially. What do you think is going to happen with this?
I mean, I've got, I can say that, yeah, law students everywhere know and despise the Blue Book. I think for our non-legal professionals that are listening, they might be surprised to hear, and I know our legal professionals will not be surprised to hear, when you get to law school, you learn about there's so much gatekeeping between the general public and the law. I know the EFF has been pushing for, you know, open law platforms before, the idea that the law should be readable, everyone should have access to it. And the Blue Book is just another example of just this isn't the way to do it. You know, the fact that it's solely printed by the Harvard Law Review Association, and they really came down with a copyright argument against these guys that were writing Baby Blue was annoying, especially considering that, the actual system of citation is not copyrightable in the first place. Washington Post quotes to Section 102B of the Copyright Act that does say that, you know, procedures, processes, systems, or methods of operations are not copyrightable. So I think that anyone that was sort of following the Blue Book, Baby Blue threats were probably pretty sure that that was going to get overruled from the beginning. You know, this is exactly what I love. Let's open source the law. Let's make it more streamlined. Let's modernize it. Let's, you know, take the power away from these ridiculously huge conglomerates. And just some other insider baseball history. Yale and Harvard have sort of been having a what's the word that's okay to say? An argument disagreeing over the origins of the Blue Book. For a while, both Harvard and Yale were claiming that the Blue Book was originally theirs. So that's, I think we talked about that a couple of weeks ago on This Week in Law. But I love Baby Blue. I think it's great. I think that it's it's licensed under Creative Commons, which is wonderful. They're fighting the good fight. So keep on them.
Yeah, if we're truly going to have a legal system where people are able to competently represent themselves, which is the one that we say that we have, you need to have all the tools to be able to do that. And having a system of citation that's not going to, already you're looked at askance if you represent yourself in court. So, you know, if you want to be able to do the best job possible, you need a way, a guide, to be able to cite authorities to the court, in a credible way. And that's, what Baby Blue promises to be, one that is free and readily available online. So we'll make Baby Blue 2 our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law and move on to our tip of the week and our resources of the week. We'll start with the resources, actually, because we have several. A couple are events coming up in the near future. One of them is from the IP Law Foundry, where Tiffany is a fellow. Can you tell us about the event in San Francisco on March 3rd?
I'd love to. This is actually an event for the Internet Law and Policy Foundry, but it's co-hosted by the Wikimedia Foundation. So on both fronts, I think these are fantastic organizations, of course. And we are hosting an open house for the Internet Law and Policy Foundry. And we're also including a panel discussion on privacy with panelists from McKesson, CDT, the FTC, Wikimedia, and Gibson Dunn. So it's going to be an exciting event, hopefully. It will be free, but registration is required. And we do usually sell out for our events. So if you want to register, check out the website that Denise is looking at right now and sign up today. It's March 3rd in San Francisco.
Ask a quick question of Tiffany about the Internet Law and Policy open house.
Sure.
I will unfortunately not be able to make it, but I'll be headed to another internet policy making seminar, actually. But I'm wondering if there will be some kind of a recording that I can listen to later, because this is right up my alley and I'm super interested in what the speakers have to say.
I'm so glad to hear that. We will have this event live streamed and recorded.
Yes.
So you can follow along, you know, right at around 6 p.m. or you can watch the recording afterward. So thanks for asking that. And I'm glad that you're interested in the event. I mean, as a privacy person, I think it's interesting. So I'm glad to hear that other, you know, tech law geeks also want to attend.
Yeah, I was super disappointed at the timing of it.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. But it's streaming.
Yeah, I wish I could make it up as well, but I'll catch the stream for sure, definitely.
Great. So love to have you guys.
Our other tip of the week is that this week is the 20-year anniversary of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, frequently called the most important part of the internet. Yeah, that was past 20 years ago. So, Tiffany, do you want to talk a little bit about Section 230 and really why we should be thanking it?
Sure. Well, Section 230 is really the reason why we have, let's say, Google, Twitter, Facebook, really anything you can think of online right now. The reason why we can have content online, the content that we know and love, is basically because we have Section 230 protections. So this is something that, you know, I can't really speak about on behalf of my employer, because Wikipedia is another one of those wonderful online platforms that I'm sure everybody uses every day. But 230 is something that protects platforms against certain certain issues involving, you know, IP infringement and issues that could really shut down websites and online platforms like Wikipedia or like YouTube or like Twitter. And we're seeing a lot of pushback on 230 and similar structures right now. But it's important. It's an important thing to follow.
Right, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it has been called the most important bill of the internet. It's what allows social networks and Google and everyone else to really function today. So let's all give a, you know, silent thank you to Section 230, 20 years old today or this week. Here's to 20 years more. So thank you for that. Other resources of the week. So we covered the IP Law Foundry and Wikimedia privacy event. Crypto Summit 2.0 is also coming up. We've got that in the show notes as well. That's going to be March 30th, 2016. It's a summit talking about privacy rights. So definitely check that out as well.
All right. Thank you so much. Sorry to cut out on you like that. But I definitely appreciate our panel joining us today. It has been a really fascinating episode of all of these ongoing privacy and other concerns. If you love what we've talked about on the show today and would like to join us every week, we do record at 11 o'clock every Friday, 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. We hope that you can join us then and jump into IRC with us if you'd like at irc.twit.tv as we record live. If you cannot, don't worry about it. Head on over to twit.tv/twill. Our whole archive of shows is there available for your perusing pleasure. What else can I tell you about? Well, we mentioned that our discussion points are at TagPacker, tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. You can also get in touch with us between the shows. Sending me or Emery a tweet makes a lot of sense because we check those out. Yeah, please do.
They're very helpful.
At Emery Roan, I am at Denise, I am at D Howell. And definitely this show is a joint project. I wrangle together links in the middle part of the week and let our guests know what we plan to discuss. But most of those links come from the folks who watch and listen. So we really do want to be covering the things that you'd like to see covered. So do get in touch with us. I'm Denise at twit.tv if you want to send me an email, or head on over to Facebook, facebook.com/thisweekinlaw, or YouTube. We have a channel there where you can also pick up our past episodes of the show. There's a Google Plus community and page for the show as well. So any of those ways to get in touch work well. We hope that you will. Keep us posted for folks, too, that you'd like to see us invite on the show, topics you'd like to see us covered, things that you'd like to know more about, such as the trademark issue that we discussed today. That clearly it would be great to bring, say, Rebecca Tushnet back on the show or Marty Schwimmer and dive a little deeper on that. So we'll put that on our board of things to follow up on, and we'd love to hear more from you about things you'd like us to follow up on too. We are going to be dark next week, but we'll be back at the end of February on our regular Friday schedule. We hope that
The February 26th episode is going to be heavily focused on blockchain and Bitcoin stuff. So if you find that at all interesting, make sure to tune in. I'm definitely very excited for it. We got some great guests.
I am too. And I know Emery is deep into that world and those issues and has been instrumental in putting together this wonderful panel that we have coming up for the end of February. Tiffany, it's been wonderful having you on the show. We're so glad that you've been able to make the time. In addition to the Internet Law and Policy Foundry event that you mentioned already, is there anything else that you'd like to let our listeners and viewers know about before we wrap the show?
I think that's about it. Thanks so much for having me, Denise. And it's been great talking to everybody on the show today.
All right. Thank you for joining us. How about you, Reg? Anything you want to leave folks with before we sign off today?
No, I think I actually just want to tell people to look up the key signing key ceremony that ICANN and Diana put on every 3 months. This is one of the things that I think is really super cool about how the internet works, and just nobody knows about it. So that's the thing I'm going to plug. Thank you so much, Denise and Emery, for having me on again.
Wonderful to have you back on again, Reg. All right, folks, we'll go ahead and sign off. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Take care.